So I will basically talk about applications of Galois theory to anion theory. And I really don't know if it's useful or not, so you can decide afterwards. First thought about the title. I was thinking field theory of anions. And then I realized that's misleading, because a field theory to a mathematician has nothing to do as a field theory to a physicist. You know, if you open up an algebra book, there's a whole, you know, about half of the book says field theory, and you won't find anything really field theory. So, for most of the people here. And actually, yesterday after listening to Michael Friedman's talk, I realized I have to tell you a story about field theory. So for the last two quarters at Santa Barbara, Michael Friedman and I, we were taking classes from Matthew Fisher on quantum field theory of many-body physics. So one day after class, we were talking about field operators, which is something pretty big in field theory. So we were confused. And then we went back to CSI, so somebody, I think the student, was waiting for Michael Friedman. So if you were in Michael's talk, so Michael performed his artificial intelligence test right away on this poor guy. He said, oh, you know, I have a question about field operator. And he started writing down, you know, his field operators and started spreading the question. And that poor guy looked at that and looked puzzled and say, you know, the only field theory I know is Galois theory. But I've never seen field operator in Galois theory. So apparently I thought he must be a mathematician. So there we go. So I'm going to talk about Galois theory. And I really don't know if it has anything to do with the field operators, but it might. If I got it right, so Galois theory was introduced by these two gentlemen. I'm pretty sure I will pronounce their names wrong, Debord and Gorin, in 1991, into the study of conformal field theories. And if you follow the chain of identifications, first pointed out by Witten that top particle quantum field theory is almost the same as conformal field theory. And then by Vladimir Turayev, that top particle quantum field theory is almost the same as modular tensor category. And now those two efforts really, really rigorously proved, I think. There's some subtleties of both claims. But I talked to Turayev about this. His whole book is to prove that TKFT is equal modular tensor category, but he didn't really do it. There's a little bit of subtlety. And asked him what his opinion of this problem. He said, you know, I consider the theorem is done. It just what the definition, not quite right. So whatever we need to do, we need to change the definition of what them to make it right. So then I realized there's nothing for me to do. So I really have not worked out that problem. So if you follow this chain of thoughts, so Galois theory is useful for conformal field theory, and therefore useful for TKFT, therefore useful for modular tensor category. And we believe modular tensor category is the theory which we use to describe anions. Actually, I have to emphasize the unitary modular tensor category. It's the language for anion existence. So therefore, we are trying to make a case that Galois theory might be useful for physics.
So you might want to add unitary to the other two things.
True, but I will say something, but if I want to make the identification, I have to be U everywhere. But I really don't want a U, but the reason I put a U in front of modular tensor category is to protect myself. I will make statement probably true only for unitary modular tensor category. And
so when you say Galois theory, you mean actual Galois theory or analogs of Galois theory?
It's the true classical field theory. That's something physicists will think, you know, it's called classical field theory, which is Galois theory. The classical, you know, the genius Galois discovered to show that there are no radical formulas for degree five and high polynomials, not any fancy generalization. So here's the problem, which I'm interested for a while. I've been I was thinking this quite a few years, really, very hard a few years ago, then for the last year and a half, I didn't really do anything because I'm just learning physics. So the question I'm interested is, actually, on Monte Carlo, and then today, and also I think I've got quite a few talks which give a very good introduction to the modular tensor academy set up in Grand Cooper Room 2. So I will just go ahead with the question. So suppose you have a set of particle types, and in the mathematical language, they are isomorphic classes of simple objects in a modular tensor category. And then you are given a set of fusion rules, and you ask the question, are there any unitary modular tensor categories to realize these fusion rules? And if so, how many? And you can ask all kinds of questions, depends on, you replace the word unitary modular by all kinds of decorations, like a fusion category, that has its own industry, right? Tons of people in the world who study fusion tensor categories. And then you can talk about spherical category, which is the setup to think about doubles. And then you can talk about ring tensor category, which Kevin just told us it should be thought as a 3 plus 1 to get T. So you can work at very different varieties of categories, but the one I'm interested in is modular, because that's the one which will give rise to TKFT, which is supposed to be anions. So the warm-up case will be this case. Suppose you have only two particle types, and mathematicians always throw in the trivial particle, so it's really one non-trivial particle type. And then you take its tensor, x squared, and then they decompose, so I make something called semi-simplicity, which means every object in your category is isomorphic to some copies of each of the simple objects. That's semi-simplicity. And then you can have many copies of the trivial particle and many copies of x, but only two of them. And the question is, you know, which two integers you can realize. So I will make another assumption which make everything simple, which is assume every particle has an antiparticle. And if you don't have that, that's very difficult. So assume every particle has an antiparticle. In particular, assume x has an antiparticle. And the ground state for the trivial always is its own antiparticle. So if this has an antiparticle, it has to be the same thing, same species. So x squared really becomes x tensor is antiparticle. And then when you fuse a particle with an antiparticle, you always have the chance to go back to the ground state. So this will always appear. And then this is a simple, and then the analog of Schur's lemma in this setup said the multiplicity here is 1. So therefore, there's only one integer here which is undetermined. And you can ask for which integer you have a chance to be realized by any answer. And the answer is very surprised, actually. Not for a lot, there are only two of them. M equals 0, which is the Semyon theory, which is the precursor of Ising TKFT. And then there's this biggest star in this conference, Fibonacci. So seems like Fibonacci has a big role in top-level quantum computing. So there are only these two cases. And I won't give you an argument, actually. I gave a talk at KITP a year ago. I sketched the argument there. So and then for n equals 2 and 3 and 4, actually you don't have any modular tensor category to realize it. Actually, I would conjecture that if you just take this fusion rule, try to solve the pentagon, there are no solutions, and that's m equals 0, 1. That's probably the best you can hope for. And it's true for m equals 2, which is my student, Xu Meng Hong, he really wrote down the pentagon for m equals 2 and found there are no solutions. And that's quite a success, because that's the first case ever for something not 1 or 0 has been solved, the pentagon has been really explicitly solved. So if you ask any expert who started with this problem, try to solve the pentagon, and you will realize pretty soon it's just very difficult. So therefore, I will do something slightly different, which is I will assume you have a modular tensor category, so you have lots of structures. I will go backwards from the structures and then try to get back to this fusion rule. So I will find something called the modular S matrix first, and then back to the fusion rule. So that's the strategy. So one thing I learned from physics is that you only do examples, you don't do theories. So that's what I will do. I will just do one particular case and then illustrate the idea. So the case I will be interested in is so-called RAP3. So there are three particle types. Really, there are two of them. This is also for the ground state or the trivial particle. And for notational easiness, I will assume they are all self-dual. So I don't have to worry about upper or lower indices. And then, for the same reason I explained before, if you do x squared, because that's the same thing as x tensor is dual, so you have one copy of the trivial thing. And then you can have m copy of x and k copy of y. And the same reasoning for y, this is a y tensor is dual, so you have one copy of the trivial one, then you have l copy of x, n copy of y. And then you can ask, how do you decompose x tensor y, or same thing as y tensor x, which I assume breeding, so they are the same isomorphic class. And it turns out they are determined. They are not something which you have to specify, because how many of copies of x inside x tensor y, if you have a category which have duals, aren't a particle, it's the same thing as how many copies of y inside x tensor x. So how many copies of y inside x tensor x, that's k, so that's this number. And then this number, same thing as how many copies of y inside x tensor y is the same thing as how many copies of x inside of y tensor y. So that's something wrong with this number. Okay, so these are two numbers that determine it. And now you have four numbers, m, k, l, n. And you can ask for which set you will get solutions by anionic theory or unitary molecular tensor categories. And there's a trivial constraint, which is, if you think about this so-called associativity, which is x tensor y, tensor y, there are two ways, two different orders to do them. One is you do x tensor y, then tensor y. And the second way to do is to do the y tensor y, then tensor x. And then you just that coefficient, you will get this identity. For the coefficient, this is only one. If you do all the others, you get the same thing. So now you have really you can easily solve those for non-negative integers by giving you many solutions. And you can still have a question to decide which one will be realized by unitary modular tensor categories. And it turns out the answer is very beautiful in a sense, in the world is very simple. There are already two of them. So one is kind of a hero, another hero in this conference, which is the IC2KFT. So this is the solution which is given by this 1 sigma psi. We have a sigma squared equals 1 plus psi, and the psi squared equals 1, and then the other, this is the 5-half fusion. And it's always symmetric with respect to, you know, you can always switch x, y, so this really has two versions, but it's the same fusion. So that's the Ising. And then the other one is this so-called SO3 level 5. Actually, Nick Bernstein talk about how to do gradients for this theory, SU2 level 5. And if you just take all the SU2 spins at the level 5, you only take the integer ones. And mathematicians like to double everything, so it's the even ones. And that's the second fusion one. We have x squared equals 1 plus x plus y. And I think you can read off this fusion one. And I claim that's all.
Is that a modular tensor category? Because don't when you do modular transformations, you get the odd ones back?
No, this one is the one which really does it's close. So definitely Lou talked about this fusion rule this morning. So you have level 5. So you have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You take off the other ones.
No, no, closes, but when you do a modular transformation.
It's not singular.
And you just preserve those? Is that true for all K?
No, it's not necessarily. It's true for odd levels. For even ones, if you take the one, it becomes singular.
So there's do people have known modular invariants in the double theories?
Double you don't need modular. Double just means spherical. Anything doubles will be fine. But this is the chiral version. This is the no double here. So if you take SU2 at any level, there's a full theory.
Yeah.
And then there's a even half.
Right. But okay. So you're saying there's some modular invariant that in the double theory. I mean, that's what you need for the,
So here's a statement. Take SU2 for any level. That's a whole good theory. Mm-hmm. Now, then you can take all the even half. You can take all the even labels. or for you the spin, the integer spins. And then for odd level, that's still a good theory. And for even ones, there's some trouble with the modularity of the, well, the not the degeneracy of the S matrix. So that's the answer. So what I will show you is that it turns out really what this will tell us this is just the Galois group of something plus a Z2 symmetry. And that's what it will be. So let me try to, because this will be what I will really focus on, so let me introduce this again. And this is the modular S matrix. So if you have a Riemann tensor category, and then you have link invariant. So in particular, you can compute the link invariant of the half link. So if you label the left by the ith particle type and j by the right one by the jth particle type, then you compute the link invariant. I call this alpha case Sij. I normally call this S tilde, but I have trouble with PowerPoint to get the tilde out of this thing. Really drive me crazy. I just cannot get it out there. So I have to invent this new notation. The alpha case is the unnormalized S matrix, and the lower case is the normalized. So you have to bear with me. And mathematicians, we don't attach to notations very well. So.
I mean, you work for Microsoft, can you change it?
I need to write something to Microsoft to do. This is actually not Microsoft. This is the Microsoft pay somebody to do this LaTeX add-on. Apparently, add-on didn't work, so tilde connect. So that was, so bear with me this ridiculous notation. So the uppercase S is the unnormalized S matrix. The lowercase is the normalized, real S matrix. And then we already saw this famous global quantum dimension, which gives the topological type of entropy. So what it is if you take this a trivial particle, then you drop this component, you get this one. The value of this loop with ith particle is the quantum VI. So what I really want to use is the symmetry of modular S matrix. So I will really use the unnormalized one. So this matrix is symmetric and unitary. And really I'm using just this property to determine the fusion rules. So if you just, I will focus on the case which every particle is its own antiparticle. The notation is much simpler. And then this matrix S turns out to be a real matrix. If you just do RAP 2, from the last slide, you know the first row and the first column, they are the quantum dimensions, which will give the entanglement entropy. If you just know it's unitary, and this entropy here is determined. So, but it's not necessarily determine everything. So now let me show you the symmetry, because that's something really I will. Basically, what I'm doing is just employ this Z2 symmetry of the S matrix, the symmetry, symmetric, and then plus label Galois theory. So actually, to define the S matrix entry, you need the orientation. So I pick the orientation both are up for this two strand.
Sorry, could I ask the basic question? So in modular tensor category, why you call this Hoffman-Link S matrix? Why?
Well, that's because if you promote this to a TKFT, this will give a representation of the modular group, which is the mapping class group of the torus. And the modular class of the mapping class group of the torus is SL2Z. That's a very famous group because that's the whole number theory study. And then there's S there, which you send this guy to that one. So actually, I use a bad notation since I don't like this lowercase s. Well, it's too far back. So normally there's a presentation of a PSL2Z which is using S and T. I don't know that I have another that. I've asked Ryan if he invented it more. So. But I guess that's the borrowed that notation S. So what I want to show this is symmetric, but that's really what about. So what you do is, so you want to compute the link invariant of this guy, which is isotopic invariant. So what you can do is you can flip this one vertically. So if you do the flip of this one, I think you will get this picture. So you just flip this left black component vertically, this down and this up. And you redraw this picture. And you flip this blue one horizontally to this side, And that will give you this picture. Now if you redraw, it's this guy. And you look at the arrow, they both go up, so match up with this orientation. But IG is switched. So that shows you the matrix is symmetric. And unitarity is nothing harder than this, or just a little bit diagram we'll see. So the real thing I will use is the famous Wanita conjecture, which is a theorem, which is the following. So I will do the self-dual case just for notational easiness, as I said. So if you have a modular S matrix, and you form this NI, which is a fusion matrix, so the A-bit entry of the I fusion matrix is given by the coefficient NI AB. So if you transfer XI with XA, you ask how many copies of XB will come out at this guy here. And then the famous Wanita conjecture is this, that in this self-dual case, it's easy to see that NI are symmetric real matrices. And then associativity and gradient tells you they are commuting with each other. So you have a bunch of commuting symmetric matrices. Every quantum mechanics physicist know you can diagonalize them simultaneously by a unitary matrix. So therefore, you can diagonalize simultaneously, but that's not the power of a Wanita conjecture. The power of a Wanita conjecture is that when you diagonalize this matrix, the eigenvalue of this matrix, they are also given by entries of this diagonalizer. That's the power of this whole thing. So the diagonalizer is a diagonal matrix. And what is on the diagonal? You take the ith particle, so you take the ith rule of the S matrix. You take the ratio of the ith rule with the first rule, which are the quantum dimensions. And then you put on the diagonal, and that will be the eigenvalues of this matrix. And that's the most important thing. If you just write down in matrix form, and then any entry here, which is NIAB, that will be like a cubic thing or a linear thing. That's the famous Wanita formula, which represents the fusion matrix with the S matrix entries. That's the famous formula. So the whole point is that the eigenvalue of this one is also given by ratios of S matrix entry.
How do you see that the M's commute with each other?
It's really braiding. It's really braiding. Mm-hmm. Actually, we talked about this with Kevin. I think Kevin showed us with this picture. Remember this picture? it's like this. So I can show you. Okay, so I just make a remark because I saw this physically relevant M in Creel's talk, which says that if all this M I j equals 1, that's the same as a billion is. So I think since I'm talking about this will be fun to show to you. So it's very simple. So it turns out the physically relevant for the interferometer experiment is this M. So what it is, you take the unnormalized S matrix, you put all the quantum dimensions on the diagonal to the reciprocal, and then multiply both sides. And that's give you the M. And then if you have all the entry equals 1, then the claim is a billion, which means that if you fuse any two particles, there are only one out. So that means you take summation of all B, if you fuse I and A, should be 1. It's only one out. And to show that M equals, F value equals 1, the same thing as the unnormalized estimate IG equals DIDG. And then if you compute the fusion coefficient NI and zeros, Ni I star, and that's equals, take the trivial particle out, that will be 1, because the trivial particle always come out, because tensor I with this dual, and then this is abelian, so only one of them come out, so that's this 1. And then if you just plug in the Wanita formula, and you will see that something canceled, and then you get this di squared. So if you just plug in, so the three terms in the Wanita formula. The last term cancels the denominator, and then these two are conjugate each other, so become this. And then if you plug in this di dj squared, and di comes out, becomes summation of drs, but that's the definition of this one, that's the definition of d squared, so they cancel each other, so that becomes di squared. And that shows this is 1. Because I'm assuming unitary, so it's always a positive number, bigger equal than 1. And then from there, there's another formula about quantum dimension multiplicity, so that's give you everything here is 1. So that shows it's indeed a billion. I just thought experimental physics might be fun to do it. So that's this. So now let me explain the thing we have used, which is kind of very simple, but it's really powerful in terms of deciding fusion rules. So I already have shown you that the S matrix is symmetric. Actually, if you combine with the Galois symmetry, this single thing of symmetry of the S matrix is very powerful. So the claim is the following, which I will show later, which is you have a rank n modular tensor category, which means that you have n different particle types. And then the claim is there will be an abelian subgroup of the permutation group. And the important thing is this is abelian, such that for any elements in the permutation group, so this is the permutation of 0 through n minus 1, and the S matrix have a symmetry as follows. You take the jkth entry up to a sign, that's the same thing as the image of the J and the preimage of K. Okay? And the sign depends on the permutation, it's a little bit complicated, but I won't use the sign really carefully. So that's the symmetry. And the point of abelian is that that's really giving you only a few cases if you really want to think about it. So example, for A equals 2, there's only one of the same thing. And for A equals 3, there are these three abelian subgroups. And these have two realizations. You can permute 0, 1, or you can permute 1 to 2. Remember, I do 0, 1 through A minus 1. So therefore, all you need to do is to decide the modular S matrix depends on these three cases. So what I will show you is this case. And this will give you this SO3 level 5. And this will give you the Ising TKFT. And this will have no solutions.
Sorry, I'm confused. So S sub, there's two S's here, right? What's S sub n? It's just...
Oh, sorry.
This
S
is a symmetric group.
That's a symmetric group.
Yeah, okay. But then I don't understand. Can you just re-explain this notation, 0, 1, or 1, 2 notation?
I'm glad you made it. Oh, let me do the next slide. Then
okay, good.
Okay, so here are the case I will do. So I will do rank 3, GC3. This is a subgroup of the permutation group on three letters. And the three letters I choose is 0, 1, 2. So therefore, to give you the realization of Z3, it will be a permutation of the three numbers 0, 1, 2. So this is a cyclic permutation, so it really is just send 0 to 1, 1 to 2, and then 2 back to 0. So that's the concrete realization of the Z3.
So that's just the element of the...
Yeah, that's just
okay.
The elements.
Okay, good.
Just the elements of the... So now we'll show you how to get this fusion rule. So I claim that if you have a modular tensor category rank 3, if it's modular, it's unnormalized modular S matrix, we have a Z3 symmetry, and then I will determine its fusion rule. So by the symmetry I told you, so if you start with S00, and then by the formula, it's equal up to sign, always up to sign. The first one, the image of 0, that's 1. And the preimage of 0, that's 2. Okay? So S1, 2 is the same thing as S0 up to sign. And S1, 2, this is a 0, 1, 2. 0, 1, 2. So S1, 2 will be this guy, actually. So this should be plus or minus 1. Okay? And then if you do S1, 1, that's the image of 1 is 2, the preimage of 1 is 0, so up to sign that's a 2, 0. S1, 1 is this guy, up to sign is this guy, so it's plus or minus d2. Okay? And if you do S2, 2, 2 sent to 0, preimage of 2 is 1, so up to sign S2, 2 with this guy is S0, 1 with this one, so it should be plus or minus here. So it should be plus or minus here, plus or minus here, plus or minus here, plus or minus here. That's the only possibility of the S matrix. And now you can just play with orthogonality. And that's determine the sign of these four guys. Okay? And then you work again with orthogonality, you have to have this condition here. Because you want to be orthogonal, so just inner product those two, you will get this identity. So now I claim that's enough information to determine the fusion matrix. Well, the fusion rules. So here's the case. So if you write a fusion rule as a matrix, so that's the two matrices. So you can read off the entry. So the first row give you the 1 represent x, x tensor identity, so that's here. And then x tensor x, that's this guy. And then x tensor y, And then here, y tensor 1, y tensor x, and y tensor y. Okay? And then you write down its characteristic polynomial. I believe this is the case. I might make a mistake. But so that's the characteristic polynomial of this one. And then if you write the characteristic polynomial of this one, it's this guy. Okay, so now, go back to the Wolinda thing. The root of this P1, which is the eigenvalues of this guy, and that's the ratio of the second rule with the first rule of the S matrix. So if you go back to the S matrix, it's the ratio of this row with this one. So that would be D1 minus D2 over D1 and 1 over D2. And the second one will have root, which is the ratio of this one with this one. So it will be D2, 1 over D1, and the negative D1 over D2. So that will give you the eigenvalues, or the roots of these two polynomials. Okay? But we know if you multiply these three roots, you should get this guy. That's just high school math. And if you multiply this three number happily, it's 1. So that's the term of this number, it's 1. And the same thing, that one is also 1. Just multiply this three number, that's also 1. And now you want to say, well, I already know two of them, I need to know M and N. And I just take those two, add them together. And high school math tells us to get this number, you just need to multiply every pair of here and then add them. And therefore, to get this number, you just need to multiply every pair here and add them. And you do this, and then you do the algebra. And I think my daughter would be challenged to do this. And if you use this identity, everything cancels. What you get is they add up to 3. Okay, so those two coefficients add up to 3. And you know KL equals 1, that says Fn plus n equals 1. And that's giving the whole set of fusion rules anything possible for this homogeneous tensor category. So that's all the solutions.
Let me ask the basic question. So how many constrained equations imposed on this S matrix entrance? So how many constrained equations
I don't know, but I did ask my colleague Michael Larson, there are not enough constraints for you to decide. Maybe this is not even the right problem, so but this is not an algebraic problem, so counting degree of freedom won't work. And then
you mean some kind of guesswork?
No, it cannot. Well, the only thing you can do, probably the best thing, you try to solve it and think about it. There's no chance for you to use any algebra, geometry, or counter argument to get any constraint. Well, just constraint enough to solve it. Anyway, so I hope you see that I really like it because it's so simple, just high school math. And you can solve everything here. Okay. So now I prepare this for a more physics inclined Indian audience. So I will say a few words about Galois theory. As I already told Dirma, I'm not doing anything fancy. This I think I promised in my abstract is elementary, so I really want to make it elementary. So Galois theory is really in a sense of old days Galois theory. So it's basically a question of regular numbers versus complex numbers.
Ask a question.
Yeah.
Do you think that this trick would work for any rank case?
Because
you impose up.
Yeah. I have. Okay. Let me tell you. I will say something afterwards, but I will ask you a question. So my former postdoc Eric Rubel and my friend Richard Stone, we carry out the analysis up to rank 4. And I have no doubt we can do rank 5, but because of the Galois theory for degree 5 polynomial theorism, people always have doubts about rank 5. But I'm planning to do rank 5 just to show it's not the kind of constraint.
Okay.
I think in principle, you can fix any rank, any Galois abelian subgroup, and then try to do the problem. Should be doable, but it's just a messy case by case argument.
Okay.
So the Galois theory, when I learned quantum physics, I started to like it a little bit more. So it's kind of like a quantum mechanics over rational numbers. So what you do is you have some polynomial and you have roots. And then classically we don't want to do linear combination, but in Galois theory actually we do linear combination of roots. And the only thing is that you do with rational coefficient. And then there's another small thing, which is you not only do linear combination because of algebra, it's a field, so you also want to multiply them and add them. So that's a slightly different from quantum mechanics. So you really have all kinds of polynomials in the rules over another polynomials of the rules. You give them all together. There is a vector space structure. So you can think of this, you take all the linear combination over the rationals, and you can ask what's the dimension as a vector space over the rationals. And that's what has a name called the degree of extension. Okay, so that's just a measurement of how big this number field in terms of linear algebra. Just ask the dimension of that vector space as a rational vector space. And then it's also a field you can multiply just as any number system. And that's basically kind of what we're about, is about this field. So in general, you don't have a single polynomial, so you might have many polynomials. So therefore, you can do a little bit more. So you can just ask something called a field. And then you have the so-called Galois group, which is all the symmetries of this field. So you ask all the orthogonal morphisms, which are mapped from K to K, preserving the algebra structure, and you compose them, that form a group. Okay, so that's the Galois group. And the easy case is this. You think of a quadratic polynomial, and I'm going to take the easy case, this is just an integer. And suppose this is not a square number, so you take 2. You have x squared minus 2. And then you solve them, there are two solutions, plus or minus square root 2. And you throw this into the rationals. So you have every member, you have q adjoint square root 2. So over the rationals will be a rational plus b over square root 2. Every number will be like this. And then the Galois group will be Z2, because there are two automorphisms if you fix the rationals. So you have to fix A, you have to fix B, and you have to say square root 2 to something, which is not a rational number. So it has to be plus or minus square root 2, and that's given the Z2. And the same thing for cubic polynomial. The thing I want to point out is that it's very common to have non-abelian Galois groups. So to have an abelian Galois group, that's quite a constraint. So therefore, I can define the Galois group of the fusion rules. So if you give the set of fusion rules, you can just find out all the solutions to the characteristic polynomial, and then make a field by throwing them all into the rationals. And then there's a Galois group of that field. It turns out there's a little bit you to prove. This is called Galois extension of Q. It's a little bit technical. So, and that's what we call the Galois group of the fusion rules. So then there's this theorem, which I mentioned at the very beginning, which is the Galois group of any modular tensor category is abelian. And that's actually a big constraint on the theory. I really like it because whenever I see non-abelian, it seems like a little bit hard to realize physically, so abelian is easy. So I have to say, those two gentlemen really did a case for conformal field theory. We kind of did a case for this, but I'm pretty sure it's the same proof.
I
will mention that in next transparency. I don't know why that should even be mentioned, but it's so obvious. Anyway, so we'll come later. Okay, so this is a theorem I mentioned. So there's a so-called, you can think about, instead of solved each characteristic polynomial, you can consider the unnormalized S matrix, and then throw all the entries into the rationals. And that will give you also a Galois group, and it's for unitary modular tensor categories, always the same as before. The reason is the first rule up here is all the quantum dimensions. And then the other entries all have denominator which is quantum dimension. And you can always multiply by quantum dimensions. So therefore, this ratio is the same thing we have just this guy. So this is the same Galois group.
So what's Q here?
Q always means rationals.
So then I don't understand what Q adjoined with all entries.
This is supposed to be a mathematical terminology. It means that, so you have a bunch of numbers. And
maybe a join is the word.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, join.
Oh, I think I, yeah, sorry.
Supposed to adjoin.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's what I mean. Okay, so what is Q adjoined with all that?
Yeah. I want this to pass quickly. So let's see.
You just add the additional.
That's not the problem of PowerPoint. Okay, so I would say that the formula I give you is something very simple. So just Galois theory plus a Z2 symmetry. So what you can do is you have a Galois pool of the anonymized S matrix. You can apply a Galois symmetry to each entry. You get a new matrix. And you multiply the inverse of this with this S matrix. And then you can show this turns out up to a universal constant, which is the global quantum dimension thing. It's a permutation matrix up to sum. So a permutation matrix is a matrix which has 0, 1 everywhere. It's not singular. And this one, the 1 might be minus 1. That's all. And if you have this, then you can solve sigma s in terms of this 2. And then you know if s is symmetric, the Galois image is also symmetric. So you identify those 2. And you solve this, you will give a formula like this. And then you write down in coordinates, forget about the signs, and that's this formula. So it's nothing fancy, just a Z2 symmetry combined with Galois.
So
and we already see it's very powerful.
Why is it that Galois symmetry changes the S matrix so little?
I do have an answer. I'm about to speculate at the end, but I think the reason is that if you look at the fusion rule, basically everything is an integer. So it's very easy to see if you have an S matrix, if you do Galois symmetry change, you still get the TQFT. So we know how rare TQFTs are.
Yeah.
So therefore, if this is a question I think I want to ask the physicists in the audience, which is this is the unitary versus non-unitary. I'm about to speculate that it's, if you want to classify modular tensor categories, really classify up to Galois symmetry. And I want hope that each Galois kind of a group have one which is unitary. And then you know they are all kind of related some way, but they are very rare. So that's why they are really so. So now you have a general strategy to classify modular tensor category. So you just fix a Abelian subgroup of some SN. You play the game. Sometimes very easy, sometimes very hard. As I already mentioned, so we work out the case for rank up to 4. And it's very rare. So, you would think, from all the construction this morning, very easy to come up with a top part of quantum field theory. Actually, the lesson is pretty rare. Something. Okay, so, before I ask questions, I want to say a few words about something which is related to Galois theory, but slightly different. So we heard two talks, actually more than two, Greg Cooperberg and Kelvin, and about this so-called double TQFTs. And the beauty of this is there's a beautiful formulation, understood by Alex Kitayev and Greg Cooperberg, and really explicitly written down by Michael Levin and Xiaogang Wen. So I call this a Hamiltonian formulation of the triad of visual TQFT. And this is really incredibly beautiful, so let me use this as an excuse to say something about Galois things applied to this. So just remind you the construction, because I want to use this. So quickly, so if you have a surface, and you think of a triangulation, which means every face is a triangle. And then if you dualize this triangulation, you get a trivalent graph. So here's a triangulation, and here's a trivalent graph. So, and then you can form a Hilbert space. So you put on each edge on the dual trivalent graph, a CN's degree of freedom. So basically just the indices of the quasi-particle types. And then you can write down this Hamiltonian, which is literally just the generalization of a torus code. So you have an operator on the vertex, you have an operator on the face. So the question I want to, bring up, which is something I really start to appreciate recently, is the paper by Lang and Wang, which is this really we don't, the information inside this Hamiltonian really we don't really understand, you know, the mathematician, because we don't care, because these are something of the choice. But actually this really gives some constraint on the normalization of the F matrices. So in particular, what you want is that you want this to, well, first I want to say a few things. So this Hamiltonian, all of this can be just as a torus code, so there's a gap, obviously. And this depends on the 60 symbols. So therefore, if you choose a different set of 60 symbols, the Hamiltonian will change. But you want this to be Hermitian, you want this to be semi-positive. And that gives some constraint on the 60 symbols. So in particular, if you think about thermodynamical limit, you want to think about retriangulation. If you retriangulate, then this will change. So you can think of each triangulation as the vertex of a graph, and on each vertex of this graph, and then there are moves to connect triangulation, which is mentioned yesterday by Greg Cooperberg, which is this bipyramid, and actually in the dual picture, it's this thing, the famous F move in the dual triangulation, and then you have the inflation of a vertex. So what you have in this picture, so you have triangulation of the surface, you think of this as a vertex. And then for each two vertex, you can put two kinds of edges in there. If they are related by this move, you can put an edge in there. If you relate by inflation of a vertex, you can put another edge in there. And then on each vertex, there's a Hilbert space, there's a Hamiltonian, so there's a ground space, which gives the topological state. And then what you hope is that, so this, the Hilbert space associated to this, you know, if you have a triangulation changed by this move, they have the same number of factors. So you would hope that whatever you choose the Hamiltonian, you want this to be isometric. You know, this two Hilbert space and the subspace just isometric, not just isomorphic at the vector space. And if you do an inflation, you embed in one small Hilbert space into another, kind of a direct sum, and then there's some special vectors in this extra degree of freedom. And you want that also the inner product to be proportioned. And if you do this, that turns out tells you you better to choose your F matrices which are unitary, and then a nice choice of the theta symbol, which mathematicians don't do, is to choose them as this. You choose the theta symbol as the square root of the quantum dimension multiply. And that's actually, I have to admit, is sufficient to give me nice properties, but it's very necessary, I don't know, Michael Levin might know, but that is sufficient to give the nice properties you want. So therefore, what you can do, you can ask the question, suppose you have a top particle quantum field theory, and what is kind of the minimal extension of Q which is necessary to realize the theory? Now for the Fibonacci, we know when you solve it, you want this to be, F matrix to be unitary, you want this theta symbol to be that. And if you really just solve the pentagon, and you will get this degree of freedom here. And I will show you that actually this degree of freedom here, the EI theta, which is really bad in the sense because you can choose theta to be an uncomputable number, and then inside your Fibonacci TKFT, you are hitting uncomputable things. And that seems too much. So therefore, you have to have a way to get rid of this, and this is determined by requiring the theta symbol to be positive. So if you just write down the F move to theta symbol, we'll get its two terms. And then this term drops because there's no tentacle rule, so this is zero. So therefore, the off-diagonal entry of the F matrix is given by the ratio of the theta symbol with the quantum dimensions, which are always positive. And this is always positive, so that's this is off-diagonal is positive. So that says the F matrix, these two entries should be positive. And that fixes this EI theta. So I'm happy this can be fixed, but I'm unhappy in the sense you need a non-universal physics in the sense that you have to use this Hamiltonian argument to choose it. So So therefore, it seems very reasonable to make this normalization of the F matrices by physical considerations. You choose the F matrix unitary, you choose the quantum, the theta symbol to be this value. I draw the theta symbol in a funny way just to protect myself. There are some subtlety about orientation, vertices, et cetera, or you know, glance over. So you want to choose the theta symbol to be this number. And then there's another thing you definitely like, which is if you take a tetrahedron on the two sphere and think of the one skeleton as a graph, and then apply the F move to reduce this, as Kevin told us, you can get this into a polynomial of F matrices entries. And what you want is that you want the evaluation to be invariant under tetrahedral symmetry. For example, if you take this edge, you draw a perpendicular line, you do a 180 degree rotation, this will come back to itself with an opposite orientation, and then it will change something else. You want this all the evaluation to be the same. So that's a constraint on the F symbols. So you want to solve the pentagon up to those choices. And then you have nice properties for what I call the conformal block basis. So if you have anions located in the disk with fixed positions, and it fix a total charge, and then if you evaluate the topological inner product, it turns out easy to see they are orthogonal, they have the same norm, and there's a nicer property which related to, I said, this isometric embedding up to scale. So that's give you this. Actually, this is also nice for most people here don't care too much about quantum algorithm. If you have this basis, there's a very nice classical algorithm for you to generate this basis experimentally close to uniform distribution. So that's basically give all the simulation algorithm, all the approximation algorithm for Jones polynomial. Actually can do much more, any quantum invariance. Can we just generate? So the point is that this normalization gives you a nice way to generate this basis experimentally close to uniform distribution. So I want to put everything explicitly for the Fibonacci, and you can see the normalization. So for the Fibonacci theory, which is the biggest star in this conference, so we have the two labels, we have the quantum dimensions, we have the fusion rule, we have the braiding, and we have the twist. And there are people who choose the other twist, which is the parity conjugate. And I think this one makes physics a little bit better, which is the exponent 2 over 5 is the scaling dimension of that particle. I think it's reasonable to choose a positive scaling dimension. If it makes negative, then the scaling dimension 3/5, which is a little bit bigger, so that's a better convention. And then you have the modular S matrix, the F matrix, the theta symbol, and everything here at the conformal basis. So I want to point out only one thing here. So most people will neglect this extra modular S matrix. In particular, in theory, for each particle type, you have a modular S matrix, which is for the punctured sphere torus with a puncture by their charge. And this is some independent information. If you look at this thing here, this S matrix entry is 1/1, it's a 20th root of unity. And this is the highest root of unity in the theory.
So how is that termed upon?
Pardon?
How is that termed upon the S of M?
This one determines what?
How is it defined?
It's very simple. So you talk about this torus. So the original S matrix for the closed torus. And this one just for the punctured torus. And you can still, there's still homeomorphism to shift the meridian and longitude. And there's a representation on that. And in terms of picture, it just goes like this. And you compute. If this is a 0, and that's back to the original one. Oh, I write down the entry. You want me to write down this guy.
No, I wanted to join and make it a closed graph.
Oh, I make a closed graph. Well, I try to write it as a basis, so I write down a basis for this.
So, but you wrote a tadpole. You didn't want to write a tadpole.
No, this is just a graph this is not a graph invariant, this is not a category.
No, but didn't you want to make a little string come off the B cycle as well when the A and B strings touch?
Well actually, well, I really should not write this thing. I know you ask this is zero. But I really want to write this space as a basis for this Hilbert space.
But just as you can evaluate the ordinary S matrix by taking a hop link,
and
putting labels on it, I think you can also take a pair of linked eyeglasses.
Yeah, you can do this, and then try to expand back to the original basis.
But suppose you take a pair of linked eyeglasses, so a hop link with an arc connecting the left and right circle.
This one here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a particular intrigue, yeah.
Well, no, if you call the arc tau, and you call the two circles A and B, then I think...
Yeah, that's you are doing computation.
I'm trying
right
to calculate the entries from that.
Yeah, you are calculating the entry line.
Yeah.
Stuff, yeah. But I'm going to write out the vector space generated by those bases. Okay, so then there's an observation due to Michael Friedman and myself, which is it turns out there's some confliction between algebra and geometry here. So for mathematicians, For a long time, we use a normalization which Lou explained this morning, which is in the Cochran bracket scheme. If you compute the F matrix, it's not unitary. It's something like a tau, negative tau inverse, maybe tau square, or maybe tau negative third, something like this. But the point is that there are no square root of tau in there. So therefore, you can realize the whole theory inside something with a billion Galois group. Like a 20th root of unity will do. But if you use the unitary normalization, you have to throw in this square root of tau. And that makes the Galois group non-abelian. So that kind of tells you that you cannot have the best in both worlds, algebraically and geometric. And I think this is kind of maybe something interesting in there related to Michael's question, which is why the Galois image, well, a Galois symmetry, or if you apply Galois symmetry to the S matrix, is closely related to the S matrix before. So I think what it means is that somehow you really should think of one unitary theory and then what was Galois image related to them. And in a sense, you know, they might represent some physical things, you know, when you study the topological phase. And, you know, I think the point I want to say is that things, you know, we are always saying we are interested in unitary TKFT, but I should say we should not automatically say anything non-unitary is not interesting. And what I learned is that from actually Andreas, I always made a mistake by thinking this way. So Andreas told me that if you want to get probability from quantum mechanics, there are two different ways. One is the obvious way. You take a wave function, you take the amplitude, the norm squared. But there's a deeper way to get probability, which is you take a quantum field theory, you do weak rotation, and then you start the statistical mechanics. And then there, a non-unitary conformal field theory is a perfect form to describe the system. So you cannot just ignore non-unitary automatically. So therefore, I would say that we should not ignore a theory just because it's non-unitary. So that's back to my last slide, which I really want to ask a question rather than anything to say. So there are two kinds of topological quantum field theories. The so-called double one, which is Trapp-Biro. And these have beautiful mathematical physics description. And physically, are they relevant or not is not quite clear. But the Hamiltonian formulation gives us something really, really nice, which is they are error correction codes. And they have gap in the thermodynamical limit. And on the other hand, they are physically not clear, but on the other extreme, we have SU2 level K, we believe they are physically relevant. And on the other hand, we don't have any lattice models. And actually, Kevin even said seems not a good question even to ask lattice models, because we know for sure you cannot put the theory on the surface alone, because there's this central charge equals zero mod 8 business give you obstruction. But you can, mathematicians do know how to construct them. All you need to do is pick a Lagrangian subspace of the surface. So therefore you need to modify the lattice by something like a Lagrangian subspace. I think this is a very interesting question, because you can reformulate this problem as, how do you do parity breaking, parity symmetry breaking using some kind of lattice? Because this double thing has a parity symmetry, and you want to break this symmetry. So if you have that, I think this will give us confidence what we believe, that those computations based on Ferrer-Pointe-Hall before tolerant, they will have natural error correction codes. So, and also, I have wondered a question, which is, do we really believe K large enough has any relevance to reality? If you think about K large, it's close to filling fraction 2. You know, the true ground state might just be the integer quantum hole. So there's a stability issue here. It's, I have no clue. I just asked the question here. So I'll stop here.